Welcome to the Rearview Mirror Podcast, looking back on all that we don't know and a few things that we do. All right, so we're tuning in next week, and if you're watching on video, next week is already here because this is the same quarter zip Peyton Manning that Jeff's wearing and the same hoodie that I'm wearing.
Let me get a bigger
so we're going back to back.
That's right. That's good. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
All right.
So when we kind of landed on something Wednesday and a path, big picture, you had, which I thought were brilliant, like 7 or 8 creative titles for the next 6, 7, 8 episodes. Right. And one of them was Messy Spirituality.
Yeah.
And I know, because I know you, I know you've been in a small group that was called the Messy Group, I think.
Yeah, it was. Oh, my gosh, right? Yeah.
And so why that title?
It's funny. Years ago, gosh, 30 years, four, I don't know how many years ago. I'll tell you what, it was in college. I was introduced to a guy named Mike Iaconelli. I never met Mike personally. But he was the editor of a magazine. Now, for those of you who are younger, magazines were these paper-bound.
Right.
No, but he was the editor of a magazine called the Wittenberg Door, and it was a Christian satire magazine.
Oh.
Yet it was it's kind of like the Babylon Bee today. I mean, that's where they get their idea from. I think it's from the Wittenberg Door. But he wrote a book. Iaconelli wrote a book, I bet, in the late 80s, early 90s, called Messy Spirituality. And I think it was the first time I ever saw someone or read anyone outside of the magazine really just talk about that spirituality isn't 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's not just super, you know, A, B, C, D, but that it is really messy. And that, I think that phrase has stuck with me forever, that the spiritual life doesn't have to be all buttoned down. It doesn't have to be all put together. So that's where that phrase has come from. And honestly, I think that's what I've experienced in my own spiritual journey.
I think when I read that and thought about it a little bit, I thought the same thing. I would not have equated those two things or put those two things together when I was younger.
Oxymorons, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think we both grew up in the church South, where there are a list of things you did and a list of things you didn't do, and God was pleased when you did the good things and not pleased when you did the bad things, and there was no room for mess and chaos. Yet intuitively, you see it,
right?
Relationships in the little local church, relationships in our own family that were broken, and I can remember as a kid thinking, having family lunch after church, but there's some members of the family that aren't here. They're never here. And when I ask why they're not here, we can't talk about that. I'm thinking, we just got out of church.
Yeah.
Something's going on. And I think if someone would have said, hey, you know what, we're disagreeing on something right now, and they said something that was hurtful, we said something was hurtful, we hadn't figured it out yet, I think I'd have been okay with that.
But right.
The brushing it under the rug,
yeah.
The no mess was, I couldn't get my head around that.
I think even for me, growing up, I grew up in this, I always call it a bipolar spiritual background. You know, my mom's side of the family were wild, rural, just short of snake handling, East Tennessee Pentecostals. You know, I mean, it was just like, the big dog stuff. My dad's family had been, King James Version only Southern Baptists. And so I grew up in this, like, talking about bipolar, right? Like, it's oil and water. I mean, there were things that just that weren't congruent. But in both the worlds, whether it was at the Baptist church or whether it was at the Pentecostal church, because there was the first few years of life, we would bounce back and forth some. Even at a young age, I'm talking like 10, 11, 12 years old, I would hear things in my very simplistic, childlike brain. They were so incongruent what I was hearing,
Yeah.
And I would be like, that doesn't make sense. I don't think it's that simple. I think it's harder than that. I didn't have a language for all that was going on there. But early in life, there was something about me going, it feels like this walk of faith isn't nearly as step one, step two, step three as I'm being sold it is.
Paradox.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. I think there was just these places where, I would hear the preacher preach something about, the need to walk perfect. And I would just stop and I'd think, I think I'm a pretty good kid, but perfection? Seriously? especially my high school days, I'd be like, well, I'm damned to hell forever. There's not a snowball's chance for me.
Right.
If the goal is perfection here.
Right.
You know? Of course, part of that was just the crazy background I was raised in, too. People will talk, they'll use, some people in the church world will use the language of your moment of conversion being called getting saved, right?
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, I feel like anytime I was in church on a Sunday night, there was this somebody who invites you, you need to come and get saved. You know, in other words, you need to get your act straightened out. You need to get right with God. So I got saved, I don't know, 2,500 times, it seems like, you know? But even then, I'd be like, is that how fragile God is? Does my screw up tick him off so badly that he can't love me? He can't be with me?
Yeah.
I think what it created is in me at a young age this real, unknowingly, but kind of this love-hate relationship with God.
Mm.
You know? I loved him. The stories of his grace and his goodness and his bigness and the story of Easter, the story of Christmas. My goodness, how could you not love Jesus? How could you not love God? And I kind of hated him too because, well, man, his standard's so perfect and I could never meet it. And so for me, I had no clear vision of how what we would call the gospel really works. So it was all up to me. I had to figure it all out. Now that's a mess of spirituality right there.
Man, and you talk about exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a repetitive, I probably walked the aisle 5 times, baptized 3 or 4 times,
yep.
You know, just because you go through a part of your life that there's overt sin, and what do they tell you? Well, you're not saved.
Right.
And I don't even, truth be told, I resist that term even today.
Same.
Because
I feel like I apologize using it a minute ago, right?
I think, God's always working.
Yeah.
And he's always working. He's always at work. But, man, you talk about you and I have kicked this around before, that threatened to write down things we really believe at this stage of life.
Yeah.
It's way different than what I believe then, I think.
Yeah.
Particularly around that issue, God's role. I had no clue what the gospel was or what redemption was.
Mm-hmm. You know, you think about it, in those days for both of us, we were raised in fundamentalism, or maybe even the better word is legalism. You know, there's this formula of what you have to do for God to be okay. tell me a little bit, remind me, like 8 to 12 years old, that window of life. How were you kind of regularly going to church? What did that look like, man, in your development in the younger years of life?
Love hate's a good description.
Hmm.
Small Baptist church, growing up in Arkansas. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night.
Wow.
You know, vacation Bible school. I can look back on it now and go, man, there were some really, really sweet people.
Absolutely.
At that church.
Rich. Yep.
Oh, man. And probably if you got to know them so much more than what you could see on Sunday. But the canvas was, it's almost like there was a canvas covering us, is what I'm trying to say. And you could only let out the parts of your personality that were good.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that as a kid, good or bad, I've kind of always been somewhat intuitive, and you just see the angst that they're real people and they have real problems, and this is not the place to share that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't love that. And then as I grew to be, 12, 13, a teenager, my parents got divorced, and I really didn't want to go. I thought, this is too much.
Yeah.
I just went this morning. You know, it's going to be the same 75 people that were there tonight and that were there this morning that are going to be there tonight. I don't want to go anymore. And right. But I remember feeling a ton of guilt about not going. And, slowly I got out of the Wednesday night stuff. And but you never felt – I equated church and attending church. That was the gauge of my spirituality.
Exactly. Yeah.
In my immature
– Yeah.
Life.
I think, I spent those almost 20 years in the western suburbs of Chicago, and one of the things I loved about my days up there is that you either were a person of faith or you weren't. I mean, nobody made – it's just like I go to church or I don't go to church. It wasn't the mark of your spiritual maturity was whether or not you attended church, right? Man, when we moved back to the South in 99, and, I'm a Southerner. This is my home. I love the South. And I think I forgot or was maybe shocked at how prevalent – it still is. Frequently, I'll have conversations with people as I'm getting to know them, and they'll say something. Yeah, you know, I haven't been very serious about anything in my spiritual life, but I'm going to get together because I'm going to start going back to church. And it's like, boom, there's the litmus test. There's the benchmark. Did I attend church enough?
Yeah.
And boy, I think that's so common in the part of the country we're living in. And I'm not anti-church, but I don't think that's the litmus test. I don't think that's the benchmark.
Well, I don't think so either. And I think some of the, some of that, and I think when people say that is that I just need a, I think it's helpful for some to have, and for most of us probably, to have a venue that we can work on our spiritual lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. It's easier, especially if you're younger, if you had young families. And
oh, yeah.
But it definitely wasn't, you know, people say here, you'll hear all the time, there's a church on every corner, and there is, and yet there are new ones popping up all the time.
Right.
And so, and again, nothing wrong with that. But I think for you and I, it was the litmus test of mm-hmm. your spirituality. And I think mm-hmm. as we got into our teens, 20s,
yeah,
we realized, man, maybe not.
Well, that's a great, great setup. I was just thinking as you were talking, what were some of the defining moments in your life when you began to realize, wow, maybe the way that I've heard it growing up, maybe that's not all of the story. What were some of those moments for you?
Hillary, I think I made the conscious decision when I was in my teenage years that I got to a point where I'm turning it all off. Mm-hmm. Not going, not interested. Mm-hmm. Ironically, when I was running wild in the streets, I had a part-time job at a church, working
perfect.
In the gym.
That's
you know, it, yeah, it was great. Yeah. It was, you know, talk about oxymorons, or paradox maybe. So that was enlightening. I think meeting some folks that were more real, that mm-hmm. shared some messy mm-hmm. stuff mm-hmm. was helpful to me. And then, just starting reading, I think God intervened in my life when I was probably 22 in a way that I really can't explain, other than he just did.
Yeah.
And I think he, in retrospect, I would say he worked for a long time, forever, mm-hmm. really. Mm-hmm. You know, I think mm-hmm. he's always at work.
Mm-hmm.
And he revealed himself in a different way at that time.
Yeah.
I don't know that that was I didn't do anything. I didn't pray any kind of prayer. Just, it was a moment I remember, but it was a moment in the context of all the work that he's already done and been doing and still doing.
Yeah.
So the moment in time, conversion, I don't know, maybe. But definitely that changed. And I think what that triggered was trying to read some things, the guys that I trusted, mm-hmm. and just going, man, I think that's the first time I realized that's the both and. I read a commentary on the book of Ephesians, and you're like, wow, this first time I really realized this is who I am now positionally. This is my position.
Yeah.
God he's placed me here. Now, my everyday practice is still going to look like an idiot sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll never be right mm-hmm. In this world.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a huge, that truth mm-hmm. shaped me for a long time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
still does.
Yeah.
This is, I don't believe that about every part of my life. I wish I did, but spiritually speaking, I kind of know who I am, and I know who God's made me to be, but I don't, I'm a long way from perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my practice.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think in my story, I always think about two or three defining moments that were just kind of those moments when you just tip your head sideways, you just go, what? You know, and I think one of those was, there was this professor in undergrad, and his name was Gary Riggins. And I haven't talked to him in decades, but I think of him so often because he was, the denomination that was in at that point was very, very legalistic, very conservative. But he was always this breath of fresh air because he laughed more. He had freedom with things he would say. Right. But then he was also, he and his wife, Jody, would have, there were probably four or five of us guys who were probably 18, 19, 20. And they'd have us over their house after church on a Sunday night, and we'd get pizza. And then we just have these very, very simple but profound conversations. And I remember he introduced me to reading a guy named Frederick Buechner. And I remember reading Buechner, who, you know, is nowhere in our tradition that I was raised in. And his book, the Gospel, is Tragedy, Fairy, and comedy, tragedy, fair, I don't know. It was a great book. Telling the Truth was the name of the book. But I remember reading it going, whoa, if this is who God is. I think another defining moment for me was, it was a New Year's Eve one year. I was over at my friend Kathy's house. I've had these good girl friends, like non-romantic, non-dating, and Kathy was one of those. And we were hanging out, and we were talking. Her parents were hosting a party, and somehow we got in this conversation on New Year's Eve that year of, if you had to draw a picture of God, what would he look like? And I said, I'll go first, because it's really easy. And I described this Father Time, long beard, big throne. But then I went on and I said, he's holding this lightning bolt in his hand, and he's just waiting for me to step out of bounds so he can zap me with it.
Wow.
And I was really proud of myself, because I could clearly articulate what God looked like. And I remember Kathy, who's just such a dear friend till this day, she said, wow, Jeff, that's not my picture of God at all. God to me reminds me of my grandfather, and I can go and crawl up on his lap anytime and talk to him about anything, and I know I'm always going to be met with a smile and a hug. And I remember sitting there and had these two thoughts simultaneously. She's crazy. Wow. I'd love to know a God like that.
What was your dad like?
My dad was the kindest, most gentle man you'd ever meet. Sense of humor that was great. Until he died. You got to meet him in his later years.
I got to tell a story. I got to tell a quick Ray story.
Go.
Ray's Jeff's dad. And, man, this was the funniest thing. So when my kids started driving, said, hey, you got to get some kind of job. You know, let's start working. So my son is pretty creative. He got a job at Brookdale Retirement Facility here locally.
I remember this. Yeah.
Serving food. And, man, you know, anytime a teenager's serving food, there's humor in that, you know, intrinsically kind of. So Will is waiting tables at Brookdale. Well, Ray becomes a resident of Brookdale.
Yep.
And
great years for him.
Yeah. And so there were a ton of stories just around serving the food and people forgetting what they ordered and saying it's wrong. Will brings back the exact same thing and like, oh, that's better. Thank you. You know, so just, you know, old people stuff.
I love it.
They had a concert there one night. Yeah. A girl came in to sing, and so they lined up chairs in rows for the residents to sit and watch. Well, I get this, you know, sitting around one night, and I get this picture, and everybody's in this row, and there's one chair that's turned around backwards, facing the other complete opposite
direction.
The person
sitting in it.
And it's Ray. And he's sitting there. Not only is he sitting there opposite, but he's laughing, stamping his feet, you know, and then he's clapping when she's done.
Yeah.
And he's looking the complete other way.
Yeah.
And we laughed about that. Yeah. It'll never leave my mind.
Yeah.
So
no, I think my dad painted this picture of just fun, levity, lightheartedness. There's some downside that we can talk about sometime in that as well, is that there was also a lot that he didn't offer me that I need in the way of guidance and direction. But he was just a fun, good man. Mom was strict. Mom was harsh. There were rules, you know. Mom could be the enforcer more than dad, for sure. I think, as you were talking, I've never said this before, but I think in many ways, I wanted a God who looked like my dad, but the God I learned looked more like my mom.
I was going to say, where did the lightning bolt come from?
Yeah. Oh, I think it was very much, again, I'm growing up in the 60s, 70s, and I mean, there's so much hellfire and brimstone that is, hearing from the pulpit in those days, right? But I think also even, you know, my mom was such a paradox. I mean, on the one hand, my mom could love me like no one else. She would be sensitive and thoughtful, and there was so much about her that was so kind. But man, when you felt the wrath of my mom, whoo, it was a lightning bolt. I mean, it was exacting. It was precise. It was harsh. And I think there's just a lot of that image of, I learned so much more about God's holiness and justice than I did about his grace and mercy.
Hmm.
That was a lot of the background.
Hmm.
So that conversation with Kathy that night, that was a game changer for me. And about 2 years after that, I went to grad school in the western suburbs of Chicago. And two super fast stories, Steve. One, first day I get there, I'm driving around trying to figure out where my house is I'm going to live in, and where am I going to go to register the next day. I'm driving around the campus, and I passed this church that's right by the campus, and on the marquee it said, sermon Sunday night, can a Christian who commits suicide go to heaven?
Oh.
And I remember seeing that, and I remember thinking, Well, what a stupid question. Well, of course not.
Oh.
That was my conditioning.
Wow.
Right? Because you died with sin on your breath, if you please, because suicide was a sin for me. So I thought, well, I'm going to go and hear what they say. Well, I remember going and listening to this guy giving this compelling logic about the grace of God and about what suicide may or may not be and all sorts of things that are going on, including mental illness and mental health. And I remember sitting there going, oh, my goodness. It felt just like when I was with Kathy. I don't know anything about this, because the man's conclusion was not that a person would end up going to hell. It was just right. The opposite, you know? And I think for me, it was the beginning of going, I know nothing about the extent of God's grace. And then the second story is the probably 2-3 days later was the first day of class. I have this professor who comes out, J. Julius Scott, a good Southern man up in the western suburbs of Chicago, teaching at the grad school I was at. And he holds up his Bible really high, and he goes, what does this book have to say to you? And we all answered our conditioned answers. And then he looked and he says, it says absolutely nothing to you. It was not written for you. And I'm thinking, get me out of Dodge. What have I done?
They got a heretic in here teaching.
Yeah. But what he would do is he would take the next few minutes to slow down and say, what was the context of the Bible? How was it really written? Why was it really written? And he just gave us historical, grammatical, hermeneutic. How do you begin to understand and interpret the Bible is what he was doing for us. And I remember by the end of that class going, wow. Just because it says this one sentence, I better understand the broader context of that sentence. You know, in my background, my parents never wore any kind of gold jewelry, even a wedding band. They never did. Yeah, because the Bible said, don't let your outward adornment be from gold. I think it's in 1 Peter or something. So the denomination I was raised in took that and said, you can never wear any kind of jewelry, any kind of gold. And my parents were loyal to the cause, so they didn't.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you have a healthy understanding of the Bible, you realize that's not the point of those few little words right there. It was taken so out of context.
Right.
But again, it was me realizing faith is a lot more messy than I was raised to believe it was.
It's not as black and white.
Great way to say it.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting. There's no other book. I found myself in my early 20s, really kind of after God intervened a bit, not a bit, he intervened, really kind of nerding out on some commentary and some things.
Maybe that, said it for you.
You know, and for me, context is a helpful thing.
Yeah.
Like one of the sermons, one of the turning points sermons I heard early on is a guy in Dallas, and he just walked through in about 15 minutes the history of the Bible and the history of man.
Yeah.
And the simplistic Arkansas public school version of that is God creates something. He created, if you believe this, God created Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Well, then man reacted and we screwed it up. Well, God came in and he fixed it. He gave them covering and then gave them a language to communicate with each other. Well, we spread out and did ridiculous things such that God destroys the earth under Noah. Well, then he gives it back to us. And what do? Well, we're not happy. We want judges and kings and prophets, you know, the history of the Old Testament. And we're not, God provides, even though he says, this is probably not what's best, but I'm going to give it to you. It's what you want. I'm going to give you some leeway. And then we screw that up. He sends his son. We kill him. And but it's a history of God's provision and our screwing up that provision.
Yeah. Yeah,
over flaunting it, you know, sometimes purposefully just rejecting it, but his constant pursuit of us. And I thought that for whatever reason in my brain, that big picture analysis gives me comfort.
Yeah.
You know, and because there's no other book that you take out a sentence or a line or a chapter and read. Nobody opens a John Grisham book and reads chapter 37.
Right.
You read it from start to finish.
Right.
And so it makes sense to me that you take into context the entire Bible and the entire time we're here on earth and give God a chance to finish it out.
When you hear the phrase messy spirituality and you think about, the last decade of life, you know, whatever, as you're growing, as you're understanding more, How do you see messiness still a part of your daily journey?
I think I've just learned to, let me say it this way. I hope I'm learning
yeah,
to.
That's a good way to say it.
I hope I'm learning to embrace it more for me, but man, really to give grace to other people.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm healthy and I let other people be who they are, I'm probably decently enjoyable to be around.
Yep.
When I'm not, I'm not.
Judgmental, right? Yep.
Cynical, judgmental. Mm-hmm. And just giving people, you know, and I'm thinking about even my own family.
Yeah.
You know, let my wife be on her faith journey and just be there to listen. Sometimes I do that well. A lot of times I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Be there for my kids, my friends, wherever they are. But I think learning messy is okay. And even more than okay, I think it's almost necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really true. It's just a matter of whether people are telling the truth or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, one of the things you hear or I hear constantly is there's a need for connection. People need connection. Humans need connection. Social media feels like connection. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But, you know, with connection comes mess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you got to be okay with both.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when I moved here in 1999, came back home to Tennessee, and I was with a group of leaders, and they were talking about what is community. And I remember I just walked up to the board, and I wrote, community is blank. These were church leaders. And I said, fill in the blanks. And it was community is love, community is kindness, community is connection, community is caring. I mean, it's like, I don't know, 20 words in a minute, you know?
Wow.
And they're all good words. Like, I wouldn't argue with any of the words, right? And I said, well, in my new role working with you and equipping you to lead better, let me fill in the blank the way I will fill it in. And I went, community is, and I took the marker and I wrote in the blank, messy. Community is messy. Because I think anytime you're doing a relationship, there's a mess to it. And maybe it wasn't always that way. You know, maybe back in the Garden of Eden, when God created this perfect little world, maybe it wasn't. But since then?
Only in that snapshot.
Yeah, that's my point.
Then,
that's my point. I think it always has been messy.
It's a mess.
We just don't know how to talk about it. And I think that's what creates so much tension for a lot of people is that, again, people look at people of faith so often, they go, my goodness, they look so good and on a Sunday morning when they go to their church, or everything seems to be so right. They've got it all together. I could never be part of them. And right. I think that's one of the greatest injustices we do is not being willing to tell the truth and go, hey, I'm struggling. I'm hanging on by a thread. I'm not okay right now.
Yeah.
And that messiness, I think, is attractive to people. Not so they can just stay messy. I don't think that's the goal, but it's going, gosh, we can hold both. I can be a mess, but there can still be some spirituality or can still be some deep work happening in me simultaneously. And I don't know. I think that's why I'm so compelled or so attracted to that, of just going, yeah. What it was Brennan Manning who talked about it and said that God loves us just as we are and not as we should be, because none of us are as we should be.
He also said, this is probably more appropriate for me, I'm an angel with an incredible capacity for beer.
Well, that's the other quote I was thinking about.
Like,
absolutely.
Man, and it's just, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, I think realizing that, and I think if I would have known that, again, I'm looking back, I'm not armchair quarterbacking leaders of any group, but when you start talking about community in the church world, it goes to small groups, you
yes.
know, churches yep. are encouraging you, and I do think you need community, and small groups is a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, but you get very little explanation, generally speaking, on what you described.
Yeah.
You're going to join a group. You're going to connect with all these people. It's going to be life-changing. You're going to have these friends for life. Well, that happens. You know, mm-hmm. We talked about on our pilot broadcast, our friend Barry. Well, I met him in church startup, small group years ago.
Wow.
He's still a friend. I love him and his wife and his family. And, you know, and there have been other groups I've been in that I couldn't get out of fast enough.
Right.
And it was terrible.
Yeah.
And I don't say that so you never do one again. I say that so if someone has that experience, they go, all right, so I've had this one wasn't great. Maybe I'll try another one or try a different way. It doesn't take away from the fact that we need human interaction
mm-hmm.
and a place to download our brains, thoughts, mm-hmm. emotions. Mm-hmm. It just may that mechanism may not work in that time,
right.
And that's okay. Try it again,
right.
You know.
Right.
And but I think you get a lot of the positive and not a lot of maybe what comes with mm-hmm. it sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that for me, trying to be okay with messy spirituality is, as we're kicking around right now, is it helps me with the old philosophical, you know, debate of the problem of evil. You know, there's these three statements, and any two of them can work together, but it feels philosophically impossible to put all three of them together. And the three statements are this: you know, God is good, God is all powerful, evil happens. It's like, okay, well, God is good and evil happens. Well, that one makes sense because God's not very powerful. That's how I could make those two work.
Right.
Or God is good and God is all-powerful. So, okay, we live happily ever after. It's like La La Land. Or God is all-powerful and evil happens. Ipso facto, God must be evil. The problem is all three of those are true statements. God is good, God is all-powerful, and evil happens. How do you put those together? And I think so much of my background was so black and white that there always had to be this buttoned-down reason why evil happened, and it usually came back to, well, because you did such and such. Instead of realizing that spiritual life is so much more complex than that, and being able to, as we've talked about before, and I'm sure we'll talk about more, is we have to be able to embrace paradox. We have to be able to hold that dynamic tension that in a world where there is a God who is good and who's all-powerful, for some reason that I'm not going to sit here and say, I can explain it to you in three easy sentences, Steve. Evil still happens.
Tragedy I have no idea why. Happens. Why?
No.
And that question that you ask, how do all three of those things exist? Somebody must have done something wrong. I mean, that's in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And was the blind man or the paralytic man, who sinned?
Yeah.
And they asked Jesus, who sinned, him or his family, his parents?
Right.
There's got to be, blame has to be attributed
mm-hmm.
somewhere.
Mm-hmm. We're such a cause and effect people.
I mean, particularly, I think, in this region. And I think what you just said gives me a lot of comfort. I do think all three of those things exist. I have no idea why evil exists.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
The only thing I would say is what we talked about earlier. I think to be fair, you have to give God till the end of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I've always said
you know?
That I think the word that will be used most in heaven is not hallelujah, but the word that will be used most is oh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so that's oh, it. Yeah.
Exactly.
I agree.
You know, I think we're so blind, and I'll be the blindest, but I think we're so blind in this world, and I'm looking so hard to make it make sense instead of being able to go, it doesn't make sense. It's that C.S. Lewis Chronicles of Narnia, you know, when is it Lucy who asked about what Aslan's like?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
That's great.
Is he safe?
Oh, no, he's not safe at all.
Yeah, but he's good.
But he's good.
And I think there's something about that, Steve, that I think the older I get, the more I just go, there was an old song from the camp meeting background of my youth, we'll understand it better by and by. And the older I get, the more I go, that's one of the most brilliant lyrics ever written.
Yeah, it is.
As you said, it's not till the end of the story do we understand fully.
Yeah. I think so.
It's why this print that hangs above our little desk here has always been so important to me. It's a reproduction of an 1840s artist named Thomas Cole.
Hmm.
And the name of this print is called The Expulsion from the Garden of Eden.
Oh, wow.
And if you've never seen it, Google it sometime, pull it up where you can see it really good. But if you drew a line right down the center of it, on the right side, everything is light and airy and beautiful vegetation, gentle waters. There's a pretty little pond back there. I feel like I could take my shoes off and run barefoot through that grass. It's like Augusta, thick, lush grass. You know, it's just beautiful looking. And you get on the left side of the print, and there's very little vegetation. Everything's windblown, broken trees, gnarly, volcano at the top. But right down in the middle of it, there are these two little pictures. It's Adam and Eve walking away. I remember our mutual friend Al Andrews said years ago, you know, we were created to live in a place where everything works and where there's an answer to every problem.
Mm.
The way he said this, Eden flows through our veins.
Wow.
In other words, that desire for everything to be perfect, that's what it's pumps endless. Through me. I want it all to work. I don't want my marriage to be hard. You know, I don't want to have questions. I don't want babies to die. I don't want evil to exist. That flows through our veins because that's what God created
what we're
us
made
for.
Yeah.
But we live outside of the garden. Mm. We live in this place where it is hard, where it is difficult, where things don't make sense. And, you know, one of my favorite little things in the Bible is there are these little places where you find, I think, little keys to what God's saying is, where he's saying, it's all going to be okay. Hold on. You know, because, you know, in Genesis 3, when all this falls apart, it falls apart. And when Adam and Eve are banned from the garden, there's this tree there called the tree of life. And suddenly they're no longer with it. That's why death enters the world. But when you read the rest of the book and you get to literally, I think it's the last or the next to last chapter in the Bible, John's talking about heaven in this new place, and he says, and there was this river and the tree of life. Hmm. And you think about it, the tree of life is in Eden, the tree of life will be in heaven. Steve, we live between the trees, and between the trees, it's really messy. It's just like life doesn't always work the way it's supposed to. But back to little Lucy, he may not be safe, but he's good.
Yeah. Reconciling that or being okay with that?
Oh, it kicks my butt many days.
What is it when you reconcile with that well, what does it bring you?
I think the phrase I used starting in 1979, right after my mom died, unexpectedly. I remember writing my little red Bible. I wrote, I need an eternal perspective. And I think that's when I take that big breath and go, I don't understand it. I can't make sense out of this. But I know he's good, and I know he's working. He's always up to something, as you say all the time. I think it gives me this eternal perspective, this sense of going, okay, there's more going on here than my limited vision can see. And when I get to that place, and it's a battle to get that place.
Sure is.
But when I get to that place, I don't know, there's just something in me that just goes, okay, well, let's go to bed and we'll get up and try again tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
But that's messy.
I mean, it's, my family's made fun of me, not made fun, but they're, you know, giving me a little bit of grief right this. I think I say it all the time. I think I say it more and more because it explains more and more. And I don't mean it flippantly, but I, Genesis 3.
Yeah.
It's really the root of everything that causes us angst. If you believe this story, if you believe the Bible, believe the story, it's the root.
It's where everything fell apart.
It's not an all-encompassing explanation or an exhaustive explanation, but it is the explanation.
Yeah, it's enough to know that everything got broken.
It's all broken.
Yep. And therefore, and, I've never thought of this, if it's broken, it's messy.
And it's not going to be fixed totally. This side of eternity. Yeah. I don't think there's any data to support it being fixed here.
Right.
Totally.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But
And again, let's hold the two things that we do so much in our conversations. And there are moments here where it's really beautiful and it's really good, right? You know, that one of my favorite little phrases I learned later in life, because you know, when you start embracing messy spirituality, you start thinking about how everything's broken, it's easy to become almost like pessimistic or cynical or, well, hell, nothing's ever going to be good, you know?
Right.
But I remember stumbling over this one little verse in the Psalms that says this. It says, I would have despaired unto death had I not seen the goodness of the Lord while still in the land of the living. And I think that's the ultimate messy spirituality paradox, is that I have to be willing to see, gosh, it's messy, it's broken, it doesn't make sense. And there's something good going on, too.
I don't want to neglect that. I definitely know that I can get into that melancholy. You know, I can go there probably pretty quickly. But echoing that, I remember my grandmother, one of my grandmother's favorite verses was, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good."
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, boy, you've had a pretty rough life. And for you to say that, but what I never knew until recently, I read it, the second half of that verse says, "Oh, the joys of those who take refuge in him."
Yeah.
And man, I just thought,
Steve, that's rich.
It's good, you know, and she was one of those people, I think, living under that canvas of that little small, and I mean small in every sense of the word, community. And that she probably knew the second half of that verse well. And she took refuge knowing what was going on around it. And it just made me appreciate her more. It made me appreciate, you know, again, I said this earlier, my mom gave me the freedom to kind of be who I was, and I didn't have to live in that small world.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for that,
yeah.
You know, to her for that. And other people in my life did that. But, man, just that's where the refuge is.
I love watching you talk about this. I mean, if we go much longer, I'll have you in tears right here.
No, we can't do that. No, not early on.
But no, this
and you're going to put it on MySpace, but and it's going to be embarrassing.
MySpace, yeah. That's
is that still a thing anymore?
Yeah, that's one of the socials. Okay.
Yeah, don't put that on.
No, but I'm genuinely, I love this part of you when you're able to look back and connect those dots and realize that that's part of the legacy that your grandmother gave you. And it took you years to discover, no wonder she could delight and oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. She knew her place of refuge. That's pretty cool.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, we'll probably quote him a few times, but Richard Rohr, everything belongs.
Yeah, it all fits in. I think when you were telling that story about your grandmother, it made me think about if somebody say, well, Jeff, messy spirituality, you know, what do you mean by that? I think the quick definition I would give, or some, not even definition, but the story I always think of from the Bible is in the Old Testament. And the Old Testament has crazy stories, like how do I even make sense out of some of these stories, you know? And they're just so like, people really did that back then? God was okay with it? I mean, you know, talking about walking by faith, it's really hard. But one of those stories that's crazy is the story of these, we call it the three Hebrew children, these three Israelites who were living in a country outside of their homeland, and there was this king who they loved and who loved them, but they had very different foundational worldview and faith beliefs. And so this king builds this altar, you know, and he's going to say everybody's got to bow down and worship this new god he's created, if you please, right? And these three kids, even their names are weird, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are natural names. Or what was it? Medea said, "My Shack, your Shack, and to bed we go." You know, but those kids have this encounter with the king one day where he says, "Hey, y'all, I've made this edict throughout the whole land. You've got to bow down and worship my god. You've got to worship this idol." And they go, "Oh, king, live forever. We love you, but nope, not going to do it. No, guys, you got to do it because the consequence is grave. I'm going to throw you into this big furnace I've created. I'm going to burn you to a crisp." And they go, "King, we're not going to do it. We're not going to bow down." And so there's this banter back and forth, right? And especially in the church of my youth, man, this sermon would be preached so often, and they'd get to the punchline. And there's this three-word punchline that they love to preach, you know, because the passage says something like this. The Hebrew children, they respond to the king, and they said, because he's basically, "Why will you not bow down?" You know, and they go, "Oh, king, we're not going to bow down because God is able to deliver us from the fiery furnace." And dude, when you were preaching those words back in the denomination I was raised in, the God is able, the
everybody
whole
up.
Building standing
everybody
there screaming,
yep,
they're running the aisles. You know, God is able. He's able. He'll do it all. He'll do it. He's good. He's, oh, what are you? And I truly don't ever remember as a kid anybody preaching anything more than that part of that. And I bet I heard that sermon a dozen times.
But the last part's the best.
Well, it's the most important part because it's messy spirituality. Because the boys keep talking. "No, king, live forever. We're not going to bow down. Our God is able," three beautiful words, "to deliver us from this fiery furnace." But then they have three more beautiful words. "Our God is able, but if not, we're still not bowing down." And I remember it's this moment of defiance and rebellion at one level, but it's also this moment of just complete confidence that if we burn to a barbecued crisp, it's okay.
Still not doing it.
Yeah, but if not, he's still good.
Yeah.
I think to me that's messy spirituality. God, I know you're able to blank, you know, heal my marriage, heal my parents, whatever. But if not, you're up to something still. And to me, that's the foundation of messy spirituality. And it's the foundation of a faith walk. God, I'm going to trust that you're good even when one and one doesn't look like it equals two.
And even when you say that, that's one of my favorite lines, even if you're not able.
Yeah.
And not only is it messy, I think it's theologically true. I mean, that's the truth. Even when Jesus walked the earth, every person was not healed.
Right. Yep.
And so things go undone. And he's still good.
I think that's kind of, when I think about messy spirituality, as I've been willing to just realize that, gosh, I've got to hold all of this and still realize, but he's still good. I don't know. I think that's how I navigate the next 5, 10, 20, 30, however many years I get, is just believing that and just going, yeah, I, no matter what comes. It's that old hymn, you know, whatever my lot you've taught me to say, it's well, it's good. That's messy, and it's good.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah. I love these conversations.
Yeah, it was good.
Well, we'll find something to talk about again next week.
Yeah.
And thanks for spending the time together.
It was good, man. All right, thanks.
We're out.